Welcome to the Iron Mind Podcast. Join me, Josh Brumley, as we explore the minds of those who forged their paths through legal battles, business triumphs, and creative conquests. In each episode, we sit down with inspiring individuals who've sharpened their resolve in the fires of entrepreneurship and law. From lawyers breaking barriers to entrepreneurs overcoming obstacles, we uncover the stories behind their iron wills and innovative minds. Get ready for thought-provoking conversations, practical insights, and actionable advice. This is the Iron Mind Podcast. Welcome to the Iron Mind Podcast. Today, we're honored to introduce John Cummings, whose journey from Butte, Montana to deputy prosecuting attorney in Pierce County is inspiring. With a relentless dedication to justice, John's career spans prosecuting cases of child abuse and domestic violence, earning him recognition as Prosecutor of the Year in 2017. In private practice, he focuses on employment, construction, and real estate law, while actively contributing to community organizations like the Tacoma Rainbow Center and the American Leadership Forum. John is currently running for the position of Pierce County Superior Court Judge. Welcome to the show, John.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Josh.
Thanks for joining us. I want to ask first and foremost, can you tell us about coming to the Tacoma area from Butte, Montana? What made you land in Pierce County? What motivated you to pursue a career in law in Pierce County Prosecutor's Office?
Absolutely. So I've always wanted to be a lawyer, probably since I was 14 years old.
Wow.
Early on, I knew this is what I like to do. And so I spent a lot of time meeting with lawyers, when I was a high school kid in Butte, and also serving on the Model Supreme Court. I was Chief Justice of Montana State Model Supreme Court for YMCA when I was in high school. So I worked really early on to try and figure out, do I like this? Do I like working on cases and litigating? And found out I really did. I really like giving voice to people who are voiceless, and I really love the law. I like analyzing it. I like examining it. I like applying it. So I grew up in Butte, Montana, as you said, which is a mining town. They joke that it has a church on every corner and two bars. And so it's a very hardworking town. I grew up with a family that had been in the mines or electricians, or my dad worked in the power company. My mom worked at a bank and then in a lab. A silicon production lab and ran a lab there. So my parents really early on taught me the importance of hard work. I had my first jobs at 11 and moved on upward from there and have been working ever since.
11 years old as an employment attorney, doesn't that ring any red flags for you?
They were all within the proper appropriate labor laws.
Oh, good. Okay,
I think good. From 11 to 14, I was a babysitter.
Oh, okay.
And 14, I worked landscaping at my local church. And in Montana at the time, you could work at 14.
So, wow.
Yeah, you could be working for a company at the age of 14.
Well, that transitioned to your work and being a Pierce County prosecutor. You dedicated over a decade to prosecuting cases related to child abuse, domestic violence, and other sensitive issues. What drove your commitment to advocating for victims in these types of cases?
Yeah, and it's really important. It's really awesome to work in Pierce County because it's similar to where I grew up in Montana. Pierce County is very hardworking. It has a lot of different communities all blended together. And what growing up in Butte helped me learn is the importance of not just hard work, but giving voice to people. Mm-hmm. And as a prosecuting attorney, that's what I was doing. So for a significant portion of my career, I think most of it, I was working on cases, my prosecutorial career, working on cases, like you said, of sexual assault, cases involving child victims, and cases that dealt with serious assaults or murders. And what I learned is that the most important thing you can do is make sure that the person who enters the justice system, whether they're the defendant or the victim, is heard. You really need to work to understand them. I, for example, worked or lived in Spain in college and learned how to speak Spanish. And so my Spanish is not perfect by any means, but I used that as an attorney, as a prosecutor, to really welcome people, to make people feel that they are included in the system, even when they might need a Spanish translator, for example. Mm-hmm. And I understood and worked really hard on what's sometimes called trauma-informed response or trauma-informed care, learning and doing training and understanding how trauma can affect someone's memory, how it can affect someone's emotional reactions to certain circumstances. So I could explain that to jurors and also bring in the proper experts to explain that to jurors to really allow the victim or the witness who's on the stand to tell their story and be heard in the proper context so that the jury understood why they might react in certain ways and understood and heard what they had to say.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Do you have any tips for people who are prosecutors now or defense attorneys now in the criminal justice system to better serve those clients on either side of those cases?
Yeah, I think one is to actually do your research on how trauma affects the brain. It really does have a real effect on what people do and don't remember. And really use that in order to talk to the jury. I worked really hard as when I love jury selection. Jury selection is a lot of fun because you're talking to people in the community. It's sort of the most unstructured part of a trial.
Right.
And at the beginning of my career, because of that, it was the most terrifying part of any case. But I love it because you're hearing from people in the community about how they're interacting with the system. And so bring that information to the jury, right? Bring, when you're talking to the jury, talk to them about how
the
trauma.
The potential jurors, the voir dire.
The veneer, yes, yeah. The voir dire. Talk to them about what trauma looks like in their lives. Talk to them about whether or not they're going to be able to put that aside and be fair when they're in front of and listening to these victims and these defendants. It's really important. I think also as a prosecutor, because I wasn't a criminal defense attorney, mm-hmm. prosecutors need to be really committed, and I've done this, to evaluating their case with a critical eye, and when necessary, when the Constitution requires it, when you can't prove your case, really look at whether that means the case needs to be resolved or dismissed. Because the reality is, justice and the Constitution comes before any of those other pieces.
What are some common, problems with cases that you saw in the prosecutor's office that when a defense attorney would point them out, you'd say, yes, I agree. I don't think I could prove my case. What were some evidentiary issues that were maybe not based on one person or anything like that? No one police mm-hmm. officer's misconduct, but things that you saw that got your attention as a prosecutor that made you reevaluate whether or not you could approve a case?
I think one of them is I would go into a negotiation with a really firm and accurate understanding of the law. And if an attorney came in and said, I've got a motion that's going to tank your case, your confession doesn't come in because it violated the Constitution's prohibitions on self-incrimination, right? Or this piece of evidence is flawed and is going to get thrown out, or I'm going to be able to attack it. I understood the law surrounding that because I studied it intently, and I could evaluate whether this is a motion that's real, right? Or if it's something that
is a negotiation tactic.
It maybe may succeed, but may not have a high likelihood of success, right? Mm-hmm. I can remember one of my most proud moments is a defense attorney who I have a lot of respect for brought a case to me, and she said that, there's a legal problem with your case. And I said, I agree there's a legal problem with the case. The evidence is not as strong as maybe I need. But I still believe the crime has been committed. I'm not going to dismiss. And we had a nice, long, and really productive conversation about coming to a resolution that protected the community, respected any victims. I can't recall if there were victims involved, but respected the stakeholders in the case, mm-hmm. but also allowed the person to negotiate an agreement that also fit for the defense. And the judge was mad. The judge was not happy with what we did. And in that time, I was negotiating in the back room, and then I would send it out with the defense attorney to the courtroom mm-hmm. where another prosecutor would put it on the record. and the judge called me out on the carpet, which can happen and is perfectly fine, and said, why are you resolving this case in this way? I don't like that. And I said, Your Honor, I've called witnesses because this defense attorney told me to, and I don't think anyone lied when the police wrote the report. Everything was accurate, but I've called the witnesses and learned that the case is not as strong as we initially thought. I have an obligation for justice, and between you and, you know, now I didn't say this to the court, but I'm not upset if the judge was mad at me.
Yeah.
Because my job is to do the right thing, and that's what I did.
Wonderful. You transitioned from public service in the prosecutor's office to private practice. Currently, you're running for judge, but your practice includes employment law, construction law, and real estate. What inspired this transition from prosecuting crimes to employment law, construction, and real estate?
At that stage in my career, I had prosecuted crimes from the most minor crime all the way up to murder, cases involving sex trafficking, child victims, and sexual assault cases. I had really, in my mind, felt that I had begun to plateau in my career and my experiences as an attorney and a litigator. The other piece is that through coaching mock trial, I coached the mock trial team at Seattle U for about 8 years. I had met a brilliant attorney named Portia Moore, and she allowed me, with the county's blessing, to do some jury consultation in a case out of state. And through that, I got exposure to employment law cases. And it was fascinating for me. Employment law and criminal law do have some similarities because a person's job is so important. It is a lot of times what we use to identify ourselves and is so key to who we are. And I saw how high the stakes were, how interesting the law was, and how important those cases were. And so I knew I wanted to make that move. I wanted to move into civil litigation. So I had some experience. I knew where I was at. And I found some wonderful people at the time. I went to Gordon Thomas Honeywell and spoke to some amazing litigators and decided to make that move. It was a hard move, but it was a wonderful move to make.
What do you think was the hardest part about transitioning from public service to running your own business?
The ego. So I went from knowing I felt a lot about the criminal law and a lot about prosecution. I went from having built for over a decade this knowledge base and this understanding of what the criminal law required, and I naively thought it would just instantly transition over to civil, and it did not. So I went from knowing everything to knowing nothing, or at least it felt like that. And I climbed that learning curve pretty quickly. That was 5 years ago now. I feel very confident in everything I do. And I do a very good job, if I can say that. And so that was the hardest thing, is understanding that criminal law and civil law are very different. You can't just jump back and forth between them and expect to know them. It's one reason I'm perfectly set up to run for judge, is that I have that experience on both sides. And it's not a learn on the job, as one of my mentors has said. It is a job where you want a judge who understands both sides of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Experience that you talked about, the role of going from not knowing, or rather knowing a lot about the law, and then going and having that ego hit. I think that lawyers have a really great time understanding what they don't know. I forget the name of the psychological idea, but you have a beginning of your career, you think you know enough, and then you realize how much you don't know, and then you're in this tiny little area of, wow, I don't know anything yet. And then you finally, 5 years into practice, you're like, okay, now I really do know some things. Right. I can build on that. What advice can you give for helping people who are starting to realize, I don't know what I don't know, I need to start somewhere. I've never tried a case maybe, or I don't want to hurt people, so I don't want to learn on someone's case. But that's sort of the only way to do this.
Yeah.
What's some advice you have for attorneys who need to sharpen their tools?
Embrace that understanding first, right? It's when we realize that we don't know everything that the rest of law really opens up to us, right? Because it's when you believe you know everything, you're in this small encapsulated place in the law. When you realize, oh, there's a lot bigger world out there, it makes the law more fun. It makes the law more interesting. It makes the law adapt better to the needs of today, right? So that's actually great. So embrace that. Mm-hmm. And seek out mentorship with it.
Right.
Right. Seek out people who know. I am so blessed to have had so many amazing mentors who've been very patient with me and who are some of the most brilliant people I've ever met. I mentioned Portia Moore a moment ago. She's one of the best trial attorneys I've ever met in my entire life. And she and I coached mock trial together. And as I said, she was my entree into civil practice. And listening to her, understanding and talking to her, and being treated as a colleague by her from the beginning is one of the most inspirational things that has ever happened to me. So that would be the last piece. Turn around and pay it back.
Pay it back.
Don't pull that ladder up behind you. Turn around and help mentor people who want to make those transitions, who are realizing they don't know everything. Because the reality is, judges, attorneys, none of us know it all. And the ones who always get into trouble are the ones who act like they do. And right. The best ones are the ones who admit when we need some help. We need
the
some
humble
briefing.
Ones.
The humble ones.
Yeah. Can you give us any tips as an employment lawyer speaking to a business owner? What are things that you see are common bonehead mistakes for employers to make with staff, especially in the law world, but just generally? What are ways people can prevent themselves from being sued by you?
Oh, I... yeah. You know, the best... There's a great attorney named Dave Luxenberg at McGavick Graves, and he has always told me, you know, the job of an employer is to do the right thing. And he does a wonderful job in advising folks on that. And that's something that I really take to heart. When an employer should, to avoid being sued, call their attorney sooner is right. Honestly the first thing, right?
Right.
But when it feels like this might be a legal issue, call an attorney. Get some advice and actually talk to the attorney. Don't try to no employer has to do it on their own, right? That's just not how it's supposed to be. And always keep in mind that the touchstone of an employer is do the right thing first, because you're working with people's lives. It's really important. People's lives come into this. And also understand that if you're doing the best you can, you're getting some your legal advice and you're doing the right thing first, you're still going to make a mistake and it's okay. You're not a bad business person because you made a mistake or because someone got mad at you. Because the reality is there are good employers and bad ones, and there are good employees and bad ones.
Sure.
Right? And so just because someone got mad at you doesn't mean you did something wrong.
That's true.
And
okay.
I've represented both employees and employers and had that conversation with employers before and said, you know, someone's mad at you and you did everything you could to do the right way, and we're going to get you through this. We're going to walk with you on this. And so... don't kick yourself, right? You're doing your absolute best. I have a lot of respect for business owners, especially small business owners like yourself.
Thank you.
Who are under a lot of pressure and a lot of stress.
Yeah. It's a separate hat to wear when you're a lawyer who wants to try cases and do the best thing you can for your clients, and also an employer who wants to do the best thing you can for your employees.
Right.
Can you discuss maybe some very specific employment law that you wish every business owner in Washington State knew, or every business owner in Pierce County knew, like, for example, yeah. Termination letters, or there's a number of employees that once you have over a certain number of employees, different laws apply to you.
Yes. So there's a couple of things I'd say. One is, I think you're thinking of, I believe it's 8 employees or more, and mm-hmm. certain laws apply. I would also say, though, that And I can't, you know, I would say you'd want to talk to a lawyer specifically, because there are certain circumstances where 7 or less, those laws can still apply to you. So what's really important is maybe not to go with the number itself on the number of employees.
But build those practices no matter what.
Precisely.
Right.
I think two things that spring to mind about I wish all employers knew. One is that every employee is entitled to inspect their personnel file once a year. So employers should be keeping a personnel file on their employees. And secondly, for that piece, making sure that if an employee requests it, make it available. Send them a copy, make it available, you know, for their inspection or something to that effect. The other thing is that there is a law passed that came into effect in 2022, I believe, called the Silenced No More Act. It might have been 2023. What it basically says is that if there is a belief on the part of the employee that there has been discrimination, then the employer cannot offer or require the employee under any agreement, under any severance, under any circumstance, to remain silent about that discrimination. So a lot of employers that I've seen have not yet updated their severance agreements or mm-hmm. those issues. So if someone has a severance agreement that has not been updated in the last year, I would recommend they contact an employment attorney and right away talk about whether that needs to be updated. It's really important, and the violation is at least $10,000 to the employee.
So, significant.
Yes, and I don't think that it's always the case that an employer understood that or knows what that is. And there's a part of me that says, I represent employees and employers. Why am I telling people that, right?
Yeah.
Don't I want the $10K for my client? The reality is, what's more important is that the law be complied with.
Right.
There's a law, and it needs to be complied with. Yeah. That's the most important thing.
In a perfect world, we wouldn't exist.
That's true. That's true. In a perfect world, we wouldn't exist.
So what about termination letters? I've heard, you know, from lots of different employment attorneys that termination letters, if someone asks for a termination letter, we're required to give them something in writing that says you were terminated on this date. Do you have any advice about those?
They're very specific. So the advice is to talk to an employment lawyer the minute you get that request, mm-hmm. right? And so talk to an employment lawyer, because they are very specific. It depends a lot on whether or not there's a collective bargaining agreement, whether or not there's certain statutes that do and do not apply based on the kind of work you do. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that's the main important thing. Talk to an attorney about it.
What about small and solo practitioner attorneys with one or two or three employees? What if we don't have access to an employment lawyer? What are ways we can learn about the laws that apply to us in a safe, preemptive way before we violate a law?
Right. So I think first of all is there's a lot of opportunities for good CLEs, like continuing legal educations. So it can be a business expense, right? You go and you pay for the CLE and you get the employer side training. I would say be realistic. Lawyers are sometimes the worst at complying with employment law. And so be realistic about whether or not it is a good line item for your budget. It might make sense to budget in some legal consultation regarding HR issues or employment issues, because in the long run, it might save you on some liability later. I would also say talk to your insurance carrier. Your insurance carrier may actually have some recommendations on resources and lawyers, because they have a vested interest in protecting you, right?
From, That's wonderful
from
advice.
That sort of liability in the future. That's... And then make friends with employment lawyers. We're nice
yeah,
people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a great way to get free advice, right? Just take you to lunch.
I'm not guaranteeing anything.
So for young lawyers or aspiring lawyers, paralegals, people in the legal community who don't have, you know, the tenure of experience that you have or that the people that have mentored you had, how can they give back to their communities? What can a young lawyer do or a paralegal do to help impact a community in a positive way without those years of expertise?
I think the first thing that I've mentored a lot of people who've wanted to give back to their community who are lawyers, paralegals, or other legal professionals. And one of the first things I always ask them to do is sit down and think about what makes them feel the most fulfilled. They could go and volunteer with organization X or clinic Y or whatever group they want to, and they might do it for a year and then stop doing it because it's not fulfilling. And the reality is their legal career takes a lot out of them, right? Mm. And so the first thing is, what makes you feel most fulfilled? Were you a college athlete and you really enjoyed playing volleyball? Okay, find a volleyball team that, or club or sports league that you might want to work with that might need some help from a legal standpoint, right? They might need help with their bylaws or with some sort of anti-discrimination work or something to that effect. Or do you really have a strong construction background and you really want to work on putting that to use to help the community? Go volunteer for Habitat for Humanity or something else, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It's really important, I think, for the person who's going to do reaching out into their community for it to be authentic and real.
Right.
And that means following their passion.
That's great advice. When I was waiting for my bar number, I stumbled into the Tacoma Pro Bono offices and said, hey, I don't know anything about anything, but I'm happy to learn. Sit me down with someone, and I just want to help people.
Yeah.
And there's an incredible need in the family law clinic, and I didn't have family law experience, but they partnered me with a wonderful attorney who recently passed away, Becky Lamont. Becky was the first attorney who ever taught me anything.
Oh, wow.
And I just shadowed her and then eventually was taking clients after I was licensed, was taking clients on my own from that clinic to just give advice. And it was something that I didn't know I had a passion in family law, but helping people for 30 minutes to just understand what was expected of them and understand what this stack of paperwork meant brought people to tears on such a regular mm-hmm. basis. It was so rewarding. It was so powerful. And it gave me the first building blocks, my first foothold in the law, that I was building a network with other lawyers. I was learning how to be a litigator, and I was learning about client interaction and, right. and all of those important tools that we need to be successful in private practice. And gosh, I couldn't have done it without that volunteer experience. I would not be who I am today without Becky Lamont and Tacoma Pro Bono. So I definitely recommend anyone listening, take some time, volunteer for Tacoma Pro Bono. There's lots of different programs that they put on that they'll teach you how to help people, and you get the benefit of being the one-on-one attorney helping to solve a real legal problem with someone in the community. It's so powerful, so rewarding. Could you explain to us how you get ready for a trial, from the initial analysis of the case to figuring out best strategies for the case plan and how to execute that plan? Do you have checklists and tools? What do you like to use?
So the first thing I do to prepare for a trial is really craft my narrative and what is really going on and how I'm going to show that to the jury. So one thing I say to a lot of my mentees is, you write your closing argument first. Mm-hmm. And we begin writing our closing argument in that first consultation with the client or the victim or the police officer or whomever. And we sit down and we say, what are they saying? Then we compare that to the evidence they can provide and the evidence we can get through discovery responses sure. or further investigation. Once we have that sort of, it's like the clay, right? Once mm-hmm. we have that, we really need to sit down and say, what is the most true thing that happened? And how do I put that in a way that 12 people who've never seen it before can absorb that information? And the reality is that as human beings, we are wired to hear stories. We're wired to understand what stories matter and what stories people tell. And so we really have to take that information and think about what the story is. And that's the first thing I do. And everything else I do, because a trial is really a storytelling exercise.
Sure.
You choose your jury, you have an opening, you present them evidence, and you have a closing. And what you're doing throughout all of that, hopefully, is presenting them a cohesive understanding of what the facts are and why the law requires a particular outcome. So you need to understand that storytelling. What's really important as well, and what makes that work best, is when there's a judge as well who understands that that's what's going on, because they understand, oh, there's a story that's being told, and if the story is contrary to the law, prejudicial, violates the rules, that judge needs to be able to see that and pick that up. So that's what I do when I prepare my case, and you need to do all of that before your first deposition, because everything else, as I said earlier, flows from those depositions. So you really need to know your story, and because life happens, you need to be able to adapt when evidence that you thought was happening isn't actually going to happen or come in.
Right.
And adapt that.
Right. When you're getting ready for a trial, what do you focus on to ensure that you're most prepared? Like, how can you outperform opposing counsel? What can you do to make sure that you know this case better than they do?
Before I file my first pleading, I researched the law. I know what the law is at the outcome, at the outset. And if I don't have a legal position, that's going to, obviously, we're not going to be able to go to trial one way or the other. So I think that's the first one. And then the second is to understand those facts so thoroughly that they're really part of, almost like part of my heart, right? Really internalize and understand the facts. And then that way I can listen during the deposition. I can listen during the trial itself. And if, can I give an example of that?
Sure, please.
So I tried a case where the defendant was charged with several counts of sexual assault against five different high school girls. And what had happened in that case is sort of the same modus operandi, or the same method happened over and over, using drugs and alcohol to get things done. There was a point at which he mentioned that he had this very distinctively described marijuana grow operation in a hidden part of the house. And he just happened to mention it. And then the first victim who testified happened to mention it. But he had said something to the effect of, well, they were never in that part of the house. It wasn't possible for them to ever see it. They never saw it. I never showed them the marijuana, nothing. Well, then how could the first victim so distinctly describe it? And so I knew the other facts of my case really well, so my mind was freed up. And what I could listen for is, in the second victim, I could ask that person, did you ever see anything unusual? And sure enough, they had seen, and they could describe it. And the third victim, and the fourth, and the fifth, even though the insistence was that they'd never seen any of it, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a case where I really learned the importance of a number of things. It's important to hear people, right? And hear their position. Women, men, non-binary people, all people.
Sure.
But we have certain systems that make us maybe not want to listen to certain people, right? Mm-hmm. So listening and believing these girls was really important. Testing the evidence for dang sure, right? I didn't just believe out of nowhere, but understanding it was consistent with the evidence. And then really listening to my case to understand, oh, what was said was consistent with what they said. It corroborated it and undercut the claim that was coming from the other side. So when you're listening to a trial, you really have to understand your facts, but you also really have to understand the
power of active listening.
That's a great way to put it, Josh. Yeah. The power of active listening.
Yeah, yeah. I think that by being so tuned in to what we expect someone to say, you might tune out what they actually say.
Right.
And so I was in a deposition for a family law case. It was maybe one of the first depositions I took many years ago.
Yeah.
And it was an in-person deposition before COVID with the mother of the children who she was refusing to let my client have any visitation, and for no reason, basically.
Yeah.
So he started getting a parenting plan in place, and we took her deposition. And she wanted to say he doesn't pay to support these children, this and that. And my client, during the deposition, kind of just was sending me elbows, you know, like, hey, ask her about all the times I gave her money. And, you know, I ask, and I've got my outline. I'm trying to stick to my outline and make sure the evidence that I need is coming out. And she says, yeah, he's given me money. And he's like, ask her about the casino. And I'm like, what? Just stop. I'm trying to go off my list here.
Right.
And the information that came out during that deposition was more than 10 times, he paid her rent so that the children and her were not evicted because she had spent entire paychecks at the casino and lost that money. And her position was, he doesn't pay for anything. But by adapting on the fly to this information that, yeah, my client probably should have given me in advance, and yeah, I could have stuck to the information on my outline, but by being receptive and still actively listening to what she was saying, and bless her heart, she was brutally honest to her own detriment about how many times he paid for things that her position was he had not. And so it was really a great learning experience, but I don't think we get to the point of being a good attorney without trying to do this work. And so many attorneys are afraid of getting trial experience because maybe they don't want to mess someone's life up. Maybe they are scared what they don't know. But you can't grow as a professional in this industry without taking those risks. And you can do it in a calculated way, like you mentioned, having mentors and having CLEs and reading and understanding the law and what you need to prove. But people trust you with their case, whatever it is, family law, criminal defense, victims. And if we're not doing a good job pressing the legal issues that our clients are hiring us for, we're not supporting what they hired us to do. So it's just really difficult. And hopefully anyone listening to this feels motivated and empowered to reach out to you for mentorship or other people that are in their network.
I would just jump on that and say, yes, and litigators need to be mentoring
absolutely
people. And
absolutely,
I think we have a lack of litigators. We need more. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important for litigators. And I have such respect for people who go out, coach and mentor young litigators, because it's huge and people need good attorneys in the courtroom.
Right. When you're cross-examining a witness on a case, what approaches do you find most effective? Cross-examination happens at trial, and you talked about trial prep as an important part of the process. Can you elaborate on cross-examination specifically?
So I think the things that make cross-examination most effective are not asking questions that you don't know the answer to. There are some exceptions, but generally, that's the most important thing. And the way we get there is by actually citing to the evidence and the depositions and things that you can actually hold the witness to. And then the next is the act of listening. You really have to be able to listen to a witness and make sure that what they're saying is registering, not, as you said, you're just going through your list of questions.
Yeah,
I think those are the two big ones. Don't ask a question which you don't know the answer, and listen to what the answer is. Because so often they'll say something that just devastates your case or makes your case stronger, and then the attorney just looks at them and then reads the next question on their list.
Yeah, it's terrible. Have you ever had to adjust your cross-examination on the fly based on that active listening? And how did you handle that? Maybe an objection was sustained that you thought there's no reason that objection should have been sustained, and it totally crushes the next line of questioning. That's why we need good judges. You know? But can you give an example? Is there anything that comes to mind of a time where you had to change cross-examination strategy on the fly?
Yes. So I was doing an assault in the first degree, and it was a case I was not doing when I was prosecuting it. I was prosecuting an assault in the first degree, and it was a case where someone had actually gone up to a house and fired a gun into the side of the house, and the bullets had actually passed within inches of a sleeping person who was on the exact other side of the wall. And one of the things that we were doing is putting forward the ballistic evidence of the gun and the bullets, because you could match them up, and some of the bullets were found in the defendant's home as well. I thought I had laid sufficient foundation for that and was ready to just admit the report from the ballistics expert. And I was in front of a judge who held me to everything, as I should be held to everything, especially as a prosecutor. You want to hold the prosecutor to the highest standard, and that's how I was held, and that's how I think it should always be. So I was held to the highest standard, and the judge said, you got to lay this foundation. Now, in my mind, I didn't think I needed to lay that foundation. I knew better. I was wrong, but I thought I knew better, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what you have to do is stop, pause, and be comfortable with the silence of the courtroom. Because sitting in that silence can be very intimidating because you think everyone's waiting for you to say something or fix it or do it. But I had to step back, breathe, pause, and think about what the judge actually wanted me to do. And then ask those questions in order to get that evidence in. The ballistic evidence was key to the case. If I couldn't get that ballistics report in, I still had sufficient evidence to proceed, but it would be significantly less certain.
Yeah.
And so than it actually was. So I think that haste really makes waste in trials.
Haste makes waste.
When you get an unexpected ruling. It is not okay to waste the court's time. You only have a little bit of time for a trial. It's like from 8:30 to 4 on a day, and there's an hour and a half break, and there's 2:15. Like, yeah. Pretty soon you have no time. But in those moments where you get the unexpected ruling, you really have to breathe, step back, and think about what you're trying to do.
Absolutely. Can you give us examples of building that foundation in a way that other attorneys can understand how to implement that when they get those same objections? Like in your ballistics example, what were some questions that maybe you could have asked prior and it would have avoided those objections or the judge preventing you from entering that exhibit on the front end?
Right. So expert testimony, to get in an expert report, you have to ask, was there sufficient facts and data? Was the methods and practices accepted in the scientific community that's relevant to the report, in this case, forensic and ballistics? And does the person testifying have sufficient expertise and training in order to opine or make an opinion that is a conclusion of the facts that have been found in the case? I laid those facts and that was it. And I thought that was sufficient. I think the thing that the trial lawyer needs to keep in mind is that's one rule of evidence, right? That's expert opinion testimony. But there are a lot of other things happening in the courtroom. And the judge was concerned with the potential prejudice or lack of probative value of this report unless I also established, for example, some information about the forensics that or ballistics that was relevant to the case. And in this case, laying that foundation, the ballistics report the ballistics expert actually said these tool marks are the most unique tool marks I have seen in my 15 years of doing forensic analysis of ballistics. And so it was information that was incredibly useful. And so it's easy to get very academic as a litigator and say, I just have to tick these three boxes. And the judge was like, no, I want to see more. And I was, of course, well, I ticked the three boxes.
Yeah.
But what the judge was thinking is, yes, and I need to know this is probative under 401. Yeah. I need to know that it's not prejudicial. I mean, even on a bench trial, I need to know it's not overly prejudicial under 403.
Yeah.
I need to understand. I get that you tick the boxes under 701, 702, 703. I'm not sure that you tick them in a way that makes me super confident in this evidence. And it sounds like you want me to rely on it. And so it was much... it was a great education for me to understand it's not just about ticking boxes. It's about understanding both the letter and the purpose of those rules.
The application.
Right.
Yeah, that's great. That's great feedback. What are some tips that you can give to lawyers who want to improve their cross-examination skills?
I would say watch really good cross-examinations. When someone is a good cross-examiner, go and watch them cross-examine someone in the courtroom. Read transcripts. So if you do any appellate work at all, read transcripts and note when the cross-examination goes really well. And watch, there's a great CLE called The Ten Commandments of Cross-Examination by a guy named Irving Younger, who was a great litigator in the mid-20th century and became a judge and has since passed. There's some information in there that may not be 100% on par, because I think it was from the 70s or 80s, but a lot of it holds. And I always had my mock trial students watch the Ten Commandments at cross-examination. It is really good for getting a basic understanding of cross-examination. And once you have those foundations, or once you have those fundamentals, you can deviate later.
Right.
Irving Younger says 25 trials and you're a trial attorney. I think that's probably a good idea. Keep the fundamentals first, and then after that you can deviate because you know what you're doing.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
We'll link that to the podcast so that people that are listening can find that as well.
Sounds good.
You've also served as a pro tem judge. You're running for Superior Court judge in Pierce County. Can you tell us about your experience pro temming and why you decided to transition again out of private practice potentially to being a Superior Court judge?
Absolutely. So I began pro temming 7 years ago in Thurston County District Court, and I've since begun pro temming in the last few years also at Lakewood Municipal Court. And that was because I actually stopped coaching mock trial so I could make that transition, which was really a hard decision because I love mentorship and taking care and coaching. But I have been so fortunate to work with people like Judge Buckley, who's presiding down in Thurston County District, mm-hmm. who really talks about how to make people feel comfortable in the courtroom, saying hello to every litigant that comes in the room, understanding very deeply the law that applies to the matters in the case so that you can treat people fairly and consistently no matter who they are or where they come from or what their lived experience is. And Judge Buckley also is essential to the Veterans Court that was created in Thurston County and the value of those therapeutic courts. And I was honored to be able to sit in on staffings and see how the court can be a vehicle of sort of a tool of advocacy that's very adversarial, mm-hmm. but also a therapeutic model that right. allows you to staff and see some people have a substance abuse issue or a mental health issue or issues caused by the fact that they were serving our country mm-hmm. as veterans mm-hmm. that put them into a circumstance where a crime was committed. But the way we keep the community safe is by preventing that circumstance from happening again
right.
and helping that person to move on and past what brought them to that scenario. I'm going to be continuing to do that work. I have a lot of respect for judges who continue to focus on those matters. Mm-hmm. And so it's that understanding of taking care of people and serving my community and really doing things that are proven to make our community safer that is really important to me as a judge. We have a situation right now where sometimes people don't have the respect for the judiciary in parts of this country. And it's very concerning for me. We need to have faith in our judiciary. And that's not a knock at any one particular judge. The judges that I'm going to be joining on the Pierce County Superior Court bench are amazing judges. Mm. And I love the work that they do. I am really looking forward to joining them and continuing to build and protect the respect for the courtroom. And that begins with treating every person, lifting every voice. And, you know, I speak Spanish well enough to welcome at least one additional language in my courtroom and explain, hey, necesitamos esperar un traduzco. We need to wait for a translator. No puedo traducir. I can't translate porque soy el juez, no. Soy un traduzco. I'm the judge. I'm not a translator.
Wonderful.
Just a little bit helps everybody remember this is your courtroom. This is the community's courtroom.
Right.
And I am there to help administer justice.
Are you running opposed for your position? Can you tell us more about your candidacy?
Yeah. I am running opposed for my position. There are two who have indicated they're going to be running. The reason that I'm really confident and excited about my race is I have that unmatched breadth of legal experience. I have 100 jury trials, which is almost unheard of for most attorneys.
Right.
I have the experience criminal and civil, which is very unique. And I have the experience of pro tem judging and actually presiding over jury trials and understanding that perspective, the criminal law from all perspectives. Mm-hmm. It's really important we have that Because right now we have in the Pierce County Superior Court and a lot of courts, this isn't just unique to them, a backlog that's been caused by COVID. And so this backlog is first and foremost a criminal backlog because in our justice system, criminal cases take priority because they deal with people's safety and liberty. And so they take priority over a lot of civil cases. You have to have someone who's not just learning criminal for the first time, I understand criminal, who can get in there and really work those cases through in an efficient manner, mm-hmm. and then also jump right into the civil cases. It's the highest level, Superior Court is the highest level jury trial court in our state system. And so you really need people, and I'm really excited to be able to bring that jury trial experience to the bench.
Wonderful. Do you have like a pitch that you'd like to give that we can send out to listeners for your candidacy? Obviously, you've got the breadth of experience in both criminal and civil, which I think personally is incredibly important as a former defense attorney, family law attorney, and now civil personal injury attorney that does trials. I really want the judge presiding over my cases to understand the rules of evidence mm-hmm. because I can't count on two hands how many times I've had an objection sustained that I thought was preposterous, but maybe the judge just wasn't listening, or ask a different question. Okay, but that's not helpful, and so I joke that we need more judges who understand the rules of evidence, and maybe that's a bit tongue-in-cheek. Our judges are very good, but what are some things that you think people need to understand when they're voting for a Superior Court judge?
You need a judge who understands jury trials, the rules of evidence, criminal and civil law. And I've got all of those things and have been focusing on them for over a decade or more. Two decades almost? I don't want to date myself. Sure. For a long time. You need a judge who's very deeply committed to the community. And I chose Pierce County as my home because I love it. My husband and I live there. It's part of our DNA. It's what we want to do, and we've been serving that community for that entire time. And you want a judge who really, really, really is going to listen and uplift every voice and every stakeholder, and that's what I'll do.
Wonderful. What you mentioned that you're a community member and that you've been working in these communities. Can you talk about some of your volunteer work and why that's important to you?
I have volunteered with a number of different organizations over the years. I run a clinic for youth right now. We're in our second year with the American Inns of Court, the Robert J. Bryan Inns of Court. Work with some amazing folks, including Mark Nelson and Seth Dawson and other individuals. I can't name everyone. Everyone is amazing. I just really appreciate our volunteers taking care of youth, dealing with name changes, which can be difficult and are really important. It's really important work. I have volunteered with with my church. St. Leo's Catholic Church, which is I've volunteered with. I volunteered with Oasis Youth Center. I was on the board of Rainbow Center, which is the LGBT Youth Center, or excuse me, LGBT Resource Center for Pierce County. I did that work for 6 years. I was president twice, vice president twice. I am on the board of the American Leadership Foundation, which is an amazing organization that trains leaders up and coming and well-established leaders. All throughout Pierce County, we have a fellows network. I think that's it's definitely over 500. I think it might be over 600. And it's individuals who really come together to implement the best leadership principles and also connect each other to really take care of the community. It's a fabulous organization. And those are just some. I can't list everything. I'm an Eagle Scout. So commitment to community and commitment to volunteerism has always been part of who I am.
Wonderful. How can people get as active in the community as you are? What are the steps that people need to understand to get involved with these organizations?
Find out whether or not what your passion is. Listen to your passion. I know a friend of mine is really involved in music. And so I was honored to be able to connect him with, for example, the Tacoma Symphony Board. Wow. And now he's on the board of Tacoma Symphony. So find that passion and then seek out those organizations. They're always looking for volunteers. If you are a lawyer, they're always looking for someone with some legal expertise. Keep in mind our ethical obligations. You can't represent an organization and be on the board. So
sure.
But tempting as it may be for people to ask you for legal advice, you need to explain to them you can't. But it is a wonderful, wonderful thing to do, to take your experience as a lawyer and really give back to your community.
Great. Our podcast is called Iron Mind Podcast, and to have an iron mind to me means to be resilient and to overcome adversity and to always try to forge the best possible outcomes for these clients. What does being an iron mind attorney with that definition, what does that mean to you?
You know, I grew up as a closeted gay kid in a mining town in Montana, and then came out in Spokane, really learned about myself in law school in Seattle, and then came to Pierce County, where people work hard at what they do and care deeply about their community. Being an iron mind is understanding that I, as an attorney, need to examine who I am and my thoughts and my preconceptions, know myself, lift the voices of the people I encounter every day, and be very committed to justice for my community.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being a guest today.
Absolutely.
It was super inspirational to listen. And when should people vote by?
People should vote for me in the primary by August 6th.
Okay.
And in the general by November 5th.
Wonderful. We'll be there. Thank you very much for being a guest, and have a good day.
My pleasure. Thanks, Josh.